That is what they did.
That was crossing the line. There.
Yeah. So
if you're looking for somewhere to vent your anger about the Caspian Susan kiss in Prince Caspian,
I caused it. I'm sorry.
Happy Labor Day, Narnie Webbers. This is Glumpuddle, and what you're about to hear is the audio from our first ever video podcast. If you'd rather watch the video, which of course I'd recommend, click the YouTube link in the description. This is a conversation with myself and longtime Narnie Webbers Rillian and Jim Fan. We were kind of the core trio in the Narnie Web podcast long before it was called Talking Beasts, back in the Prince Caspian and Dawn Treader days, but this was the first time we actually met in person. And we thought this was the perfect opportunity to discuss mistakes we think were made in the first three Narnie films that we hope will not be repeated in The Silver Chair. So listen, enjoy, and then why don't you post your concerns about The Silver Chair in the comments.
Hello, welcome to Talking Beasts, and we are on video!
Whoa! Finally!
Finally.
A small studio audience here.
A small studio audience, and also in person for the first time.
Yes, so we can actually see each other. Well, we can't see you, the viewer. Or can we? technology's come
creepy.
Quite a bit.
If the camera light is green, then you know we're watching you right now. But okay. Yeah, so we got together for our eclipse moot, and
the eclipse is actually
tomorrow.
The time this recording is tomorrow.
As of now, it's tomorrow. And we three had you two ever met?
No,
nope, not face to face.
We three had never met in person before, so this is the first time
we've
ever gotten together, and we are going to do our first video podcast.
10
Hopefully
years,
not last.
You guys.
It's come, 10 years ago, it was such a big deal just to email an audio file to someone if it was over like 10 megabytes.
Yeah, youSendIt.com was, oh my goodness, this is an amazing website that lets you actually send a file. And you wouldn't send the file. You would just download the link from this website. It took you 3 or 4 days plus a few weeks to upload each file. And now we're...
And now the irony is we finally got together in person and I still found a way to make it really complicated.
That's technology, man. Like it's always growing, it's always changing.
Blessing and a curse.
Yes.
Yeah. So what we're gonna do is for this podcast, there's actually a bit of a backstory. We're gonna talk about some things that we don't want to see in the film. We've talked about a lot of things, of course, we want to see in Silver Chair. But today we're gonna talk about things we don't want or things we might are afraid might happen, but there actually is a backstory for this. Years ago, we thought, hey, you know what we should do? We have this great day called April Fool's Day.
May
have heard of it.
And Narnie Web invented it, apparently.
People do awesome things on it, like lie to Firefly fans that Netflix has bought Firefly and is bringing it back. Things like that. Well, we did something horrible, too. And
you did the most horrible.
Though. I did the most horrible thing. So
it was
a collaborative
effort. But
so the trick was you want it to be fun, but you didn't want it to be too obvious. I mean, you wanted to kind of fool people, but it still had to be funny. I mean, you couldn't just come up with, hey, here's a fake set picture, unless it had some humor to it. So I thought, well, I'll come up with something that's really hilarious and, would be a terrible thing that they did. But I thought, well, I'll rein it back to make it kind of believable. So this is what I wrote. This was published, we timestamped it artificially March 30th, 2006. So this is the article.
Also, it was actually posted on April 1st, but the date we put was March 30th.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think that's crossing a line, personally.
Yeah. So, and by we, he means me. I crossed the line. So,
April 2006.
This is what I wrote. Andrew Adamson, director of the hit blockbuster The Chronicles of Narnia, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, said in a recent interview with Entertainment Today that he was considering different ways of making the girls more active in the plot of the next film, since in the book, they don't have much interaction with the main character, Caspian. He said that one of these ways would be adding a romance between Susan and Caspian to the Narnia sequel. Quote, the story is very human, unquote, Adamson said.
My heart still speeds up when you hear that read, even though I know what happened.
Stand
I
by.
Guess more because of what happened.
Quote, Peter and Susan never return to Narnia, and having a relationship between Caspian and Susan creates the perfect emotional conflict for the story, as well as showing how our heroes are growing up. Both want to be with the other, yet both know that their place is in their own world, unquote. Stay tuned as we cover this developing story. And, ladies and gentlemen, that is what they did!
Only worse.
Except they added a kiss, which
yes.
even I thought was...
Have them
I didn't even add
that
the kiss.
That was crossing the line there.
Yeah, so...
if you're looking for somewhere to vent your anger about the Caspian-Susan kiss in
Prince
Caspian...
I caused it. I'm sorry.
right here.
I somehow
actually yeah. sorry, not the kiss technically, but the romance.
Here's
idea.
A really aggravating thing. I didn't put it together until just now. Is this was in 2006? The movie came out in 2008.
They would have just have been starting pre-production.
Script writing.
Hey
process,
guys, we have some ideas.
It's like, the hey guys, you won't guess what Narnia Web posted. They actually think this would be cool.
Because the crazy thing is when you read that in context of like what we know actually happened, it sounds like something they actually said.
Yeah, it sounds like something
well,
they
like,
were right.
It's very plausibly written. Congratulations, I guess. So my theory, though, and that's not the first time an April Fool's joke is kind of, sorry, not the last time an April Fool's joke of ours kind of.
You think we would have learned first.
It was the first time.
I mean, we also said the White Witch was going to be in Voyage of the Dawn Treader, which she was, as an April Fool's joke. Ha, ha, ha. This just
yeah. So funny.
But I have a theory about why it seems like, I know there's some actual Narnia Webbers that think that, they really do think, oh my gosh, clearly they read our April Fool's joke and that's where they got the idea. They misinterpreted it. Oh, they're joking about it. Obviously, that's what they want. But here's what I think is the sad truth, is that the reason we thought Caspian Susan, for example, the reason we thought that was funny was because, haha, that's the kind of thing they would only do if they were just making a generic, cheap Hollywood Lord of the Rings knockoff.
Boom.
But not completely. I don't want to be too dismissive because I overall like the first two movies. But I think they were in large part kind of, they're obviously greenlit just because of Lord of the Rings. Not so much, someone had a great idea for a Narnia movie. It was... The market wants fantasy. How about Narnia? That's the next logical series to make.
Yeah.
So we were joking about things that were already kind of already true, basically. So that's my theory is why those things keep happening. So it's a sort of logical explanation, I think.
I mean, you think of what is the craziest thing you could think of. And I think you tend to hit on the thing that other people think of when they're just trying to think outside the box. Like, what can we add to the book that's not already here? And people are people. You tend to think of the same things.
Uh-huh.
So we all think of the same crazy things. We just thought it was terrible and they thought it was a good
idea. We thought it was terrible. Oh, that's the thing you do if you were just going to shamelessly over-commercialize the series and rob it of what makes it unique and special.
But I think they were to a point trying
to do that, I'm saying.
Yeah.
Not 100%. I overall like Wardrobe and Caspian, but there were some elements that definitely grew out of, let's just... make a super commercial movie.
Well, the weird thing about that is it's definitely like just the way I wrote it. Well, they both want to be with the other, but they both want to be in their own worlds. And you watch it and you think that's how they played it.
Uh-huh.
That's how they did it.
Yep.
It was kind of this little eyeballing each other. It's just like, I'm going to go kill people. I'll come back and I'll survive.
Keeping the PG rating.
Keeping this PG rating. And then, but wait, I'm going through the portal. Oh, okay.
See ya.
So what we wanted to do is actually have an actual discussion of kind of in fun, like, hey, don't do this, but also kind of what are some things that could happen and people fall into? And
Basically, we didn't have an April Fool's joke this year. Instead, we're doing this.
We're doing this instead.
The opposite approach. Rather than present it as a joke, present it as, if you're watching, here's what we don't want to happen, please.
Yeah. It's like, this is a no. This is like, hard pass, please do not.
There's no excuse for misinterpreting
FYI.
This.
Pretty much. So, first off, the question is, what sort of things do you just not want to happen? Do you just, like, okay, without even knowing anything about the direction of the Silver Chair right now, imagine you've seen
nothing. A
little
bit from the director and McGee and all
that. Yeah, we know a little bit, but really we don't know a whole lot. And so, let's just say, hey, they're making a Silver Chair movie. What kind of things are you just like, hey, don't do this.
Oh,
this is not a good idea.
That, yeah.
This is just not a good idea.
You know, at this point, we have the battle scars of three Narnia adaptations, the good and the bad. There are certain traps all three of them have fallen into.
Hashtag climactic epic battle.
Like, exactly. The thing that comes to my head is like, what do you not want? And it's like, I don't want it to end up like the Dawn Treader. And when I say that, I mean, I guess what I don't want is if... I know there's going to be changes. I know there's going to be additions, not just changes, but like additions into the story. That happens no matter the adaption. Like there's always things that change. I don't want those changes to be made for the wrong reasons. Like if it's going to be a change, it needs to work within the universe, within the story. It needs to add and not kind of make it worse. Like mm-hmm. with Prince Caspian, I felt like the changes they made with, like, you know, the added battle and like all the different stuff. Like, I know there's varying opinions about like how successful that was or whatever. But for me, from a purely cinematic standpoint, as a movie, I thought Prince Caspian was really well done. Like, they hit like all the points of like it just being a good movie. And I felt like the changes, it worked for the most part. It worked. And so I wasn't as mad that there were changes, because overall, like, as a movie, it worked, it flowed, it had like ups and downs, and it like it was mm-hmm. taking a mm-hmm. difficult book like Prince Caspian and then changing it over to a movie. I thought they did a good job with Don Treader. That
the perfect example which yeah. applies here is The Green mm-hmm. Mist.
Yeah.
Which we know they originally created to essentially lead into Lady of the Green Kirtle and Silver Chair. So yeah. That'd be my number one, I guess. No Green Mist
yes.
at all. It never happened. Yep. Throw it out. We don't need to see
Retcon.
Where it was going. Exactly. This we don't have to tie it into the Lady of the Green Kirtle. We can just pretend it never happened. After years of therapy, I'm starting to pretend it never happened either. No Green Mist. You don't have to see green smoke on the screen to know that our characters are making a difficult choice.
Well, part of the thing is we have these fantasy films, which when I say fantasy films, you have really this kind of recent trend. We had The Lord of the Rings, which was coming out, and just the way each one naturally worked, yeah. we had a fight scene at the end. And it worked pretty well within each story. We also had, you know, each of the Harry Potter movies had a climax that had some excitement, really, within each book, the way each one was written.
Uh-huh.
And
some of those more so than
others. Yeah.
yeah.
But, for example, when you have books that are very different from one another sometimes, like Prince Caspian, you can say, hey, Order Line, the Witch in the Wardrobe, hey, let's have a big battle scene at the end. And you can do that within that and take it from that story. And it works better doing it there than it does in, say, Voyage of the Dawn Treader.
Uh-huh.
And so...
where they had that the big epic sea serpent battle.
Exactly.
Totally in contrast to the emotional climax of the book.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So, whereas Silver Chair is also much more, I think, in tone. It's just not a big, hey, let's have this big fight scene. There's not armies and fighting and heroes fighting each other in these wars type of a story. It's mm-hmm. it's just not.
Yeah,
so,
and at the end especially, the real climax of the story should be, are the characters going, Puddle Glum, Jill Eustace, are they going to actually trust the signs and let Rillian mm-hmm. out of the chair? And then when yeah. the Lady of the Green Kirtle comes down and is trying to tell them Narnia never existed, and, oh, that writing you saw there, that under me, that had nothing to do with you. Are they going to buy into that, or are they going to hold on to that hope, or are they going to give into what she's saying? That's the true climax of the story, and that's where the drama, when I'm reading the book, that's where the real drama comes
yeah.
from. It's not, are they going to win this epic battle and save Narnia? Even though it's like the fact that there was, that all of Narnia was on the line, and that the Lady of the Green Kirtle intended to use Rillian somehow to take over Narnia so she would be ruler of Narnia, it's almost an afterthought in the book. It's there, but
yeah.
the real drama is about, are the characters going to listen to the signs and free Rillian? I would definitely have that on my list of no giant battle, don't have the
yeah.
gnomes break out and then fall down Phantom Menace style after the witch is killed. just have it be all about, are the characters going to follow the signs or not?
Because frankly, that type of formula, that it's easy for them to try to get into this. Like, oh, well, it worked with these films. Let's do it with this one. Because it makes money is part of the, I think,
yeah.
part of the thought. And,
uh-huh.
well, audiences must like it. But at some point, you're departing so far from the story. That type of formula just isn't going to work. It's not, it doesn't convert that way in Silver Chair.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's one of our big things is don't do a big epic battle at the end of the movie.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. We can do, like, obviously there's the battle with the serpent, which I'd be fine with, and I guess it is fairly elaborately described even in the book, battling the serpent. And I personally would like them to keep that pretty bloody, messy, maybe even have Silver Chair be a light PG-13 rating if it has to be, or at
yeah.
least push the PG as far as you can. I think that her demise, it feels right to me that it be messy. And Lewis even describes it as a terrible mess. And so we can have a big, elaborate battle scene there, but that's really
fight scene more like
battle is a word that Joe Johnston uses, like, what is, well, we did that on Don Treader, wasn't it, like, battle under the water, above the water, what does that mean, a battle, well, what does a battle mean exactly, but
yeah,
so we can have an exciting scene, but that scene is the punchline of the Lady of the Green Kirtle trying to convince them that Narnia doesn't exist, and Puddle Glum's speech, that battle really is just the punchline of that scene. It's not this big giant complicated
exactly.
thing in and of itself.
Yeah, it's the resolution.
Uh-huh.
That scene is the resolution of
yeah.
all these things that have built up, and the excitement of And it's really very much, it's a psychological journey for the reader
yeah.
in that scene as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm going to go on record here of saying it first.
Okay.
Next issue, no Jill Eustace romance.
Okay.
It's just,
you said it first.
I said it first.
I should have said it. Someone else should have said it first because last time you said it first.
Last time I said it first. This time I'm trying to amend for my sins. So
tell us, explain yeah. why. Why is this a bad idea?
So first of all, a lot of times in stories, well, part of the thing is in the story, there's an innocence there just between the two. There's this friendship that is unmuddied by kind of the romantic feelings that like teenagers have. And so I mean, this is, again, going back to, it's not even in the book, not referenced or alluded to at all in the book, but there's all these focuses of, first of all, where their loyalties are. Are their loyalties to just trying to get out and get the easy way out? Are there loyalties to Aslan and actually following the signs? And through all this this journey, there's just this incredible friendship that is worth so much in the story.
Yeah.
And friendship is its own type of love apart from romantic love. And it really, I mean, you can't help but diminish it in that short a time frame of like, well, here's this hour and a half to 2.5 hour movie. And here's this bond between these people. And to take away from the friendship that they have mm-hmm. by making it, well, of course, he's a guy, she's a girl, they're going to like each other. They're in this thing
together.
Especially
if they're both the most attractive people in the movie. Of course, they'll just find each other.
It's like, well, the next person there, like for Jill, is a Marshwiggle. So, of course, she's going to, you know, like you. No. They actually have a real friendship. Mm-hmm. And it's not just a like last man in Narnia, last woman in Narnia yeah. kind of thing. So that's just what comes to mind initially, just at first.
So I think there's I say it's a stereotype, but it's true that it feels like in most like media, books, movies, if there's two people and they're really close together, then that it's love. It has to be like, it doesn't matter how unlikely the circumstances or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's just like two people, if they're that close, they have to mm-hmm. be in love. And it's like, real life's not like that.
How often in a movie do we really see a male and female character that are just really have a well-developed friendship and that's it? You know, we definitely don't see that very often.
Yeah, it's super rare. Mm-hmm. So I think here's a good opportunity to do that. Mm-hmm. You know,
even just really deep friendships, in general, just deep friendships in film and television, I don't find are explored.
Certainly a disproportionate amount. Absolutely.
Yeah, a very disproportionate amount. I think like in some ways, I love how one of the better versions of just a really deep friendship exploration I saw, and this was in television, was the show Sherlock. Mm. They did a really good job just exploring just the friendship between John and Sherlock. Uh-huh. And so there's things like that, but it's almost like people, I don't know what kind of influence it is. I don't know if it's like, well, the fans must want this. But you see it in movies and in TV shows.
If you're just
shows.
Trying to make a commercial movie, of course, your brain's going to go there immediately. Well, what's popular? Let's make more of that. And it takes a real creative energy. Maybe a director, for example, who has a vision for the story to say.
Maybe an artist.
Yeah, just to say, hey, here's why we shouldn't do the things that. Because look, the people who make a lot of the decisions about what movies get made and what don't. And you know, and want it to be as commercial as possible and have a stake in their investment. They didn't get to that point. They didn't get in that position because they're great storytellers. They got there because they knew something about marketing.
Yeah.
About how to make something commercial. It's perfectly natural. They're going to go in that direction. It's not necessarily a bad thing. They're going to go in that. The tide, of course, will carry them in that direction unless someone says, no, don't do the obvious thing. This will be way better if we do it this way. So you need a creative force in there to make them do that.
I think it's really easy to equate like romance equals the ultimate in marketing and profitability. Uh-huh. And it doesn't have to be. Like you said, like with Sherlock, there you have it's a very commercially successful show,
uh-huh.
but it's friendship, it's not romance. And I feel like, I think it'll be extremely tempting to mm-hmm. go down the romance path, especially since I feel these days everyone's into shipping, you know, way more than it was 10, 13 years ago. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like it's just the unspoken expectation that you know, there's got to be someone that the fans can ship because that's how fans get into things.
Right.
I don't. It may end up being that, but let's just put it out there. Like,
no,
we
romance, please.
We really think they can do it without it.
And by the way, that would probably force them to age Jill and Eustace up quite a bit if they were going to do a romance. And I don't want that either. I want Narnie to stay focused on... I like the idea that it has children doing these amazing things.
Yeah.
So that would be another reason, I think. By the way, what we're talking about, kind of the easy commercial, do this because it'll probably get a lot of attention. One of those things would be, and I might need to duck behind something in a second because there's a few other Narnie Web moderators in the room. Oh, are you going to throw that at? Oh, gosh. Throw something at me. No. But it was actually a banned topic on Narnie Web for a while. I don't know if it still is.
If not, it's gonna
we'll have to address that because the Silver Chair movie is coming out, so we may have to reevaluate this. But don't put Tilda Swinton in the Silver Chair. Okay, I'm still here. Okay, we're good. But and not only don't put Tilda Swinton in the Silver Chair, don't allude to in any way this idea that the Lady of the Green Curl and the White Witch are somehow the same person or something.
Spoiler, they're not.
They're not at all. First off, there was...
The BBC version has a very limited casting budget.
And so they cast Barbara Kellermelin...
Three times.
In both. Oh, yeah, she's the hag as well.
Hag as well, and Prince Caspian.
But it's... I feel dumb even having to, talk about this. It's kind of like, well, why aren't Susan and Puddleglum the same person? Should I list the reasons? But, okay. So
it's because of the voices don't trigger. No, it's because of what we saw there. My goodness.
Obviously, there was a prophecy that the filling of the Four Thrones would signal not just the end of the White Witch's reign, but her life. Obviously, Aslan killed her. Aslan killed her, and he meant it.
And he meant it.
You know, I don't think that the witch.
You're dead.
Yeah, exactly.
Seriously.
They even say in the book. And it was all discovered at the end how probably one very similar to the White Witch, whatever that means. But they even address it in the book and say that no, they're not the same person. So, but don't do the whole let's bring back the old villain. That obviously, Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe was by far the franchise's most successful movie.
Yeah.
And Tilda Swinton still continues to be. You know, she was in Doctor Strange. She still continues to be a pretty successful, recognizable actress. It'd be the easiest thing in the world to say, can't we figure out a way to get her back? Oh, what if they were the same person? Make new things. Don't just constantly reinvent what was in. That's why we're seeing so many reboots and sequels and requels and whatever. Make new things.
And everyone's related to everyone now.
Exactly.
Like, oh, my goodness. You're my dad? You're my sister? You're my...
Why does Rey have to be a Kenobi or a Skywalker or something? Why can't she just be Rey? Why can't we just have a new character? But anyway... Thank you. Sorry.
This is a very sore subject, but I mean,
it's very emotionally trying for me, guys.
The reason why this is such a genuine concern of people is because it really felt like in Dawn Treader, the movie, that they were really trending in that direction.
Just shoehorned her in.
And we were like, no, don't do that. Just let her be her own villain.
Uh-huh.
You can have two evil women and... Narnia history. It doesn't have to be the same one.
Yeah. Uh-huh. There can be lots of evil women.
We're all about
equality.
Yeah, exactly.
There can be lots of evil women.
Lots of evil men, lots of evil
Prince
women.
Says Rillian. Send. Okay. Too late. So I feel even kind of dumb having to bring that one up. Obviously, they're not the same person, and there you go. I don't think that'll happen. We'll transition to my fears in a second here, but no, I don't actually think they're going to do that. Joe Johnson did say, no, the White Witch won't be in this movie. Now, maybe he could still have some implication that the White Witch, it's, you know, she was reincarnated. It's not the same person. Whatever. I don't know. Maybe, but okay. I don't actually think they're going to do that, but I've had to get that out of my system. It doesn't come up every now and then. The one... another, if we're ready to move on, we'll get to ones I'm actually worried about in a second.
Are we done covering?
Since we're still in that realm a little bit of the absurd, I do have one more.
Okay.
That I'll just get it on the record just in case. But it's more like a source of inspiration that I don't want for that. I don't think they should be for the Silver Chair. I actually have a visual aid here in my little bag, Santa Claus bag of tricks here, also called the pillowcase.
Father Christmas bag of tricks.
But,
you troglodyte.
So Michael Apted talked about the book C.S. Lewis didn't write. I don't know if he was referring to this or not, but this is an actual thing, and you're looking at it like you have no idea what this is, right?
I have seen this.
This is like
this devilry.
This is like the Star Wars holiday special. It's just the thing that we pretend doesn't exist. What I'm looking at is, or what I've got in my hands here is something that probably a lot of people wouldn't surprise me if even Douglas Gresham just wants to pretend this didn't
happen.
Are you
going to wash your hands after
yeah,
this?
Yeah, I think I will. But this is The Giant Surprise, a Narnia story inspired by the stories of C.S. Lewis. And this came out around it might have been late 2004 or so. So just about a year before the movie came out. I think they were kind of testing the waters, testing the market. Like, oh, are there other things we can do with little spinoff stories of Narnia? And no, I guess the answer was no, we
can't.
The
answer was no.
But it's basically about Puddle Glum and his niece Lally see these mice get kidnapped by giants. And they have to chase them down. And yeah, that's Puddle Glum. And
see,
that's
I've very heard of this, but I don't think
show
I've ever read this, actually.
I'll show pictures to the camera later. But do it in post, you know? Yes, it's just nothing at all good to say about it, basically. It was obviously written just to get as many sound effects for kids to shout as possible.
Galley Schloop.
Yep.
Galley Schlop.
Giants.
Yep. And
Giants
honestly, there's just nothing really good to say about it at all. It's like not even a good children's book at all. Like we as a group, a bunch of us Narnia Webbers, were kind of read it together just sort of for fun, and we thought we would have fun making fun of it. It wasn't even fun doing that. It was just, this is so dull.
Rock
the
sandwiches were the giants. Yum yum yum.
Okay,
that's what it says.
I'm gonna gift this to
that's
your
what it
son
says.
Soon. And you can have
no,
the pleasure of
no,
reading
no,
it to
we're
him.
Gonna raise him.
His son
corrected.
Is only like 8 months old, right? Don't put those images
scar
in his head
him.
At this
we're
age.
Gonna scar him
it's
as a young child.
this idea was okay. I understand why you had the idea, but you know, no. That's all we have to say. So just wanted to get it on the record, just in case. And
this is not source material.
Maybe The Giant Surprise is the second movie in the trilogy. A Giant Surprise, a Narnia story.
Okay.
You
well,
hit on
so,
it.
So
but
now
we can get more into the plausible kind of realm.
So now we're not going to talk about just like, hey, here's what, you wow. know, like when I talked about the Jill and Eustace thing, it's, I don't actually think that's going to happen. I don't have a fear of it happening. But on that note,
I do.
Now we're talking So now we're going to talk about not just things we don't want to happen, but here's what we are actually have a deep-seated kind of fear might actually happen, and maybe a direction they will take the movie. So I'll go ahead and start
go
on this
it.
One. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that I'm kind of afraid of, because we've heard some talk about, well, there's this question of Jill being bullied. And on one hand, it's very natural to expand it to a certain degree, because you know, in the Dave McGee interview, he said,
what's interesting in the book is it's not clear what she's been bullied about. It's not clear what's happened leading up to that moment. It's not clear what the context is. Now, to some extent, maybe it doesn't matter. The interesting thing about a book like The Silver Chair is it has an almost fable quality to mm-hmm. it. And that's fine. That's wonderful. That's a part of the book. But as you make things real on screen, and as you bring characters on screen, and it's only natural to ask, well, what is it that happened? What's going on in your world? And mm-hmm. so we spent a lot of time thinking about that.
I appreciated his response there. And at the same time, it's also easy to see how certain themes come very enlarged in certain adaptations. And so I can kind of see, like, okay, the bullying becomes this big, crucial thing. And not just a bad part of her experience at the school, but it becomes this big part of her existence. Oh, I'm this bullied person, and now she goes on this journey in Narnia to gain, and she's gaining self confidence. And there's kind of the, you know how movies do this? They have the kind of wink, wink, nod moment where it's like, ah, audience, are you connecting it? Yeah, she's gaining confidence. She's gaining confidence now. She's not going to be
there's
bullied.
There's green mist, so she must be being tempted
she,
right
she,
now.
Yeah, she's not going to be, you know, she's going to gain confidence for that bullying thing. And then later, you know, they have this kind of story arc where she gains confidence and she learns some wise lesson. And then you kind of have that moment.
Don't run from who you are.
Then you have that moment that they tie it in at the end where she's back with the bullies at school and you have the voice in the background, don't run from who you are. And then she
it.
Goes, I'm not supposed to run from who I am.
With great power comes great responsibility.
And then it's like this, oh, we've tied it all together. And I can see that kind of taking on a life of its own and just becoming a distraction from the story. Because here's what I love about the book. And this is why, even on the kind of the note and theme of bullying, it's actually more empowering, because she is bullied. It's like, hey, it's this really negative part of her life. It's not something that takes over her whole identity, but she is bullied. And then now, sidetrack, now she's on this entirely new journey. And through this journey, she learns who Aslan is. She learns what, you know, the importance of learning to trust him. And she goes on this incredible experience along with Puddle Glum and Eustace. I didn't say Glum Puddle.
No, you didn't. Okay. You get points for that.
And then here's what I love. When she comes back, it's almost an afterthought. Oh my goodness, I was bullied? Oh yeah, I guess I was bullied. It's not even like this big thing anymore.
Well, there is rushing in there with the flats of their blades and
fun.
All that. And
it's actually like a point of almost fun for the story. And it's like it's a almost playful
Experiment
resolution.
House is restored.
It's like a playful resolution to it that makes it's fun for the reader, and it's not becoming this, oh, now this encompassed all her life.
Yeah, like it's not like her overcoming this hugely traumatic thing in her life. It by that point, it's just sort of like, oh yeah, and then
I would say the trauma is kind of the emotional essence of the Silver Chair for me is that at the beginning, both Narnia and Experiment House are in a state of absolute hopelessness.
Yeah.
In the case of Jill and Eustace, just, you know, it's 13 weeks of the term ahead or whatever it is, and it's a hopeless situation with the bullies where they're being bullied and there's nothing anyone will do about it. And then we get to since I hate school so much, I just relate to that whole. And Lewis did too, by the way. Lewis literally Lewis literally wrote that he was essentially predisposed to Christianity because of that feeling of being at the beginning of the term, and there's just absolute hopeless. He basically wrote, it doesn't. And the feeling when, oh my gosh, actually getting to the end of term, when it felt like it would never come, he actually wrote, it doesn't surprise me there should be two worlds. So that feeling of, you know, so both Experiment House and when we get to Narnia, Caspian's about to die without an heir, of absolute hopelessness. Like with Prince Caspian and maybe even Wardrobe, we see a Narnia where it's hopeless, but there's still some fight. And there's that prophecy, and there's still a willingness to fight. And it seems like it's despair, but we haven't really given up yet. Silver Chair is where we've all given up. Caspian's going to die without an heir. We've already lost so many knights trying to find the prince. That's just the way this is going to be. So I think that we can sell Jill's despair about the situation she's in. I feel like what's more what you're talking about is don't run from who you are line where Bob and Larry come out and give us the moral of the story and make it like we were talking about before we started recording about let art speak for itself. If you're just going to tell us what's going on, what's the point of doing it as a story or a movie? You're just going to tell us exactly what it is. Do it in a way you can only do by doing it as a story.
When you hit on something really important, you talked about the hopelessness of it.
Uh-huh.
And that's this greater thing going on. It's what's connecting what's happening in Narnia to what's happening at the Experiment House. It's not just about, Jill's being bullied and that's just really awful.
Uh-huh.
It's not just there.
Wow.
Yeah, but sometimes those themes can kind of just take over and it's like, okay, now it's the story of the kid who got bullied now going back and getting back at the bullies.
Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah.
So I can see that taking on a life of its own. That's what I have a deep-seated fear about.
Yeah, and the fact that Joe Johnston and Hannah Magella did say, kind of emphasize that, I can see where that would be a legitimate concern they might do that. But although McGee's explanation.
Right, and I liked his explanation. But, it did make me feel like better, his explanation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I definitely see why they are choosing that particular aspect to kind of talk about and play up. Because if you look at the way, like, I've said this before, where, like, what is trending in movies and shows and media? Like, it trends. Like, there's different things. Like, Lord of the Rings started off this whole thing of fantasy movies.
Uh-huh.
And then it went into, I think the one after that was superhero movies. Iron Man, you know, kind of, Dark Knight and then Iron Man.
Spider-Man, Iron Man,
Dark Knight. All those just, like, kicked off this Marvel juggernaut, you know? And then it was dystopia. You know, you got your Hunger Games, you got your Divergent. And then it went into
probably something, I don't know.
Other things, but right
Reboots.
Now.
That's a good
time
list.
Time travel reboot.
This is a good list.
Yeah. And right now, what I feel like something that is talked about a lot is issues about like bullying and suicide. Like, there's this really popular show on Netflix that everyone's been talking about that came out a year ago, which is about bullying and suicide and things like that. So, like, people are, that is a topic that is very much discussed right now. Things, you know, bullying and what we can do to prevent it and what, how people like handle that. And so it doesn't surprise me that when they're making this fantasy movie, but they're looking at it through the eye of what is relevant right now.
Uh-huh.
And
to a point, that's okay.
Issues about bullying is sure. extremely relevant
and
right
also
now.
To a point that Lewis, of course, is writing for a 1950s audience. Of course, it's valid to say, well, this is for, 2017 or 2018 or whatever audience. That's valid to be
sure.
aware of that to some yeah. point, you know?
So it's like, yes, definitely talk about that. Because it doesn't matter if it was written, you know, a long, long time ago or now, like it is a relevant topic, but uh-huh. you don't want to turn to make that into being the most important thing about story.
Because the way Lewis wrote about it's timeless.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Some issues in life and society are the same no matter where you are.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. So yeah, I would agree. Let's not go overboard with it. Any other? I guess we should move it along. We've been going for probably like 30 minutes. We've barely gotten into beers. That's fine.
This is going to be part two, part three.
I'm not complaining.
It's okay.
It's
taken
us
12 years to get this together.
That's true.
So that's okay.
Fair enough. Let's revel in it.
So that was my first fear.
Okay. How about you, Jin Fan?
I am afraid that they are going to add too much action for mm-hmm. the sake of it, because I feel like, when you read the book, it is one of those books where it actually, sometimes it kind of...
Giants! Stone giants!
But it's a lot of it is just like, there's a lot of walking and talking. And it plays into this whole thing about like, remember...
It's a road trip.
It's uh-huh. like, remember the signs, right? Like, I don't think she would have had such a hard time remembering the signs if it was like constantly like... Like, oh yeah, we're actually like in this, we're on this quest for a reason, you know?
On a holy quest.
Promise she got comfortable and forgot that she
yeah,
almost
just,
forgot their peril and their quest.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's just like, I understand that may not really translate very well to cinema, but don't, I'm afraid they might be like, well, this is
it's too much walking and talking. We had to liven it up.
Yeah.
Have the Lady of the Green Curtle send out her little stormtrooper flying monkey minions or whatever.
Yeah, it's like, there's a way to do it.
Don't do that either.
Don't do that either.
Yeah, not that. But like, there's a way to make it. I think a way you can get around that is if you can find a way to play up the, like, add tension. Like, there's a way to add tension without it being just
physical, yeah.
Just action, you know? Uh-huh. Like, if you can find a way to play up, like, the tension, like, there's just always that undercurrent of, like, this is wrong.
In the Silver Chair,
right.
we know they're making wrong decisions
yeah.
by going to the giant, the Harfang.
Like,
we know. That's the ticking time bomb. So, we know it's a bad choice.
Yeah, so, to, like, find a way to play up that so that actually, like, the slow moments are the parts where you just kind of, like,
uh-huh.
Like, this is like this list. Like, stop, abort, go back. You yeah. should be turning. You know, but they don't.
Well, there's plenty of opportunity for that. Like
yeah.
when Puddle Glum is saying, I think we need to spend more time here. Have you actually looked at these stones? And they're going, oh, shut up, we're cold.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So like, find a way. I think there's a creative way to do that with to add that tension and that. You know, don't make it bore. You know,
don't just fill it with the stuff that looks great in trailers.
Yeah,
you
know? I'm sure you'll have plenty of material for trailers out of the last 30 minutes. I'm sure.
So don't give too much of it away.
Yeah, but yeah, I think there will be that. But that's what I'm afraid of. That it'll just be like, well, this seems like an easy way.
Yeah.
To get around this, so we're gonna go with this. I'm like, don't go for the easy way. Go for the way that fits the story, because the story is kind of one. It is a slow. It is a slow burn up until you get the end. It kind of reminds me of, uh-huh. what is it, like the, is it the fifth Harry Potter book? The one about...
Order of the Phoenix.
Yeah, yeah Order of the Phoenix is an extremely slow burn. Like, the first time I read that, it was actually an audiobook. And I was sitting in the car, I'm sitting in the car for like 2 hours, and it's just kind
More
of
like
two going...
Days.
Yeah, but it's like, it's just going on, and I'm like, get on with the story, like, come
that's
on,
not the
guys.
Silver Chair. The Silver Chair, I think.
It's not quite like that, but in some ways, like, it does kind of just go and go, and then towards the end is like when it really, that's where your action happens.
It's the bomb under the table, as Hitchcock
yeah.
put it. Hitchcock had the classic example of if you have two people sitting in a restaurant talking about baseball, very boring conversation in a movie, and then a bomb goes off. Okay, you have 10 seconds of shock. But what if, now let's do a different version of the scene where the camera pans under the table and we see the bomb, there's a bomb under the table. Now there's tension. Now we're going, don't talk about baseball. There's a bomb under the table. And there's that element of the silver chair where we know more than the characters do. We know they're making a bad decision by going to Harfang. We know they should be following the signs. And we know they're making bad choices. And we're going, no, don't do that. That's where a lot of the tension in Silver Chair comes from. And the drama at the end doesn't come from, are we going to defeat the evil villain in an epic battle? It's what choices are the characters going to make?
Yeah.
Totally see that.
Mm-hmm. Definitely, yeah, do that. That's a good way to do it. But I am afraid that it will not be that way.
Yeah.
We'll see.
Okay.
I choose to be optimistic. That's the worst thing I can come up with.
So I'll give you the other side. No. Well, speaking of being Glumpuddle, or being kind of looking at things kind of pessimistically, one of my fears is that Puddle Glum will be kind of an Eeyore kind of character. Well, obviously, some of Puddle Glum's most defining moments and thing that's sort of memorable about him is he's comically pessimistic, even when things are going fine. Oh no, it's going to be, the bridge is going to turn into mist or whatever, or I'm sure the fire is going to be wet. Of course, it's perfectly dry. But I don't see Puddle. Here's how I would summarize it. Puddle Glum's not a sad character, though. I don't see him as actually being depressed or actually being really, really sad. And to me, that's what defines the character, is that he's talking about, like, oh, we'll sleep terribly. I shouldn't wonder. End up knifing one another. I shouldn't wonder. And it's just sort of, well, it's the way it is, you know? And it's almost, it's the way it is. And what is he, as much as he's comically pessimistic, what does he really talk about? He talks about putting a bold face on things no matter what. So Puddle Glum is good or bad, put a bold face on it. And so I would like Puddle Glum to be more remembered for that than, oh, he's Eeyore. He's really, really depressed. So just to clarify, really quick, once again, it's okay to have, addressing the filmmakers, it's okay to have Puddle Glum, of course, be comically pessimistic in some cases, but he's not actually a sad character. He's not actually sad about it. That's what defines him. And also, although there's a lot of memorable moments where he's pessimistic, there's also a lot of really memorable ones where he's optimistic. Like, one of his most famous lines is where he talks about, oh, there's one good thing about being buried down here. It'll save funeral expenses.
Yeah.
No sad Puddle Glum. He can be pessimistic, but don't be actually be sad.
Do you think there's a greater risk they will make Puddle Glum an Eeyore character or just a pure comic relief character?
Yeah, I think he'd go either. I think he could be both. He could be the Eeyore character that's just all he's there to do is be comic relief. And like the humor of Puddle Glum could easily be blown out of proportion. The way I read the humor in the book is it's kind of dry and deadpan. Although I feel like Tom Baker's performance in the BBC Silver Chair is, I think he's too sad in that one. I'm in the minority on that one. I know everybody loves Tom Baker except me. I think he's a great actor and a memorable character in that movie, but it's not really book Puddle Glum because he seems too cowardly too often and just too downright sad. But I think as far as the humor goes, they do a pretty good job on it. It's very dry and subtle. You'll almost miss the joke if you're not paying attention.
Because they pull the line straight from the book.
Exactly. So, yeah, I wouldn't want Puddle Glum to be overly. Yeah, there you go. Let's just start there.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I would be worried about Puddle Glum just being the butt of a bunch of jokes, and that's kind of the only reason he's in the story.
I think he has the potential to be a really, really iconic character. Like, in literature, like, in Narnia, and I think in greater literature, he already is. But, like, if he's done right, you know, it could be that thing where it could end up being very iconic if you do it right.
Uh-huh.
So that'd be cool.
Mm-hmm. But I just hope that the really memorable character, I'm hoping that we actually have a version of, obviously Puddle Glum's my favorite character and I want him to be done right and really memorable, but I hope we finally get a Narnia movie in the Silver Chair where Aslan's the most memorable thing in it. Where they do something with him that sticks out in people's minds. And what we've seen in the first three movies, I think, is always trying to downplay his role in the story with Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe making the children really.
I hope that you have brought your majesties has weakened the witch's power.
It's really the kids that caused the snow to melt, and it's not even just that. It's 100. You've kind of opened my eyes to this a little bit. That's the most obvious example, but it really is 100 little things in the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe movie where Aslan was demoted to just sort of the Obi-Wan, you have done well, kind of. That's all he does. Let's really sell when we first see Aslan. Don't just rush through my favorite scene in the series when he gives the four signs. Don't just rush through it. Sell the fact that Jill is scared of him. This lion has claws and teeth And what do you mean you've swallowed up girls and boys, women and men, kings and emperors? Savor that and sell the fear and the awe she feels of Aslan, which is why whenever she forgets that, that's why she struggles to remember the signs. Like, take the moment to really sell who Aslan is. And even though he doesn't appear in a lot of scenes, make his presence really, really a powerful, memorable one in the story. I really don't think we've seen that yet in the movies.
Yeah. It's funny because when you think Narnia, like in the books, what is like the constant of the Narnia books? Well, it's mm-hmm. Aslan. Like, he's the one that kind of brings everything together, and he's a very, very integral, very important character. And in the movies, it's been how long has it been since Dawn Treader came out? It's
2010. So I guess we're coming up on 7 years.
Yeah.
Huh?
So thinking about, when I look back on the three movies, what stands out in my mind is, like, what is the most iconic character that, like, the general public, like, what was the iconic character that came out of those movies?
There really weren't any, I
would
say.
Weren't any.
Maybe more.
Probably
Georgie
Henley as Lucy.
More than Aslan.
And I was thinking, like, the White Witch. Like, I think that was, like, I think there's a reason why they brought Tilda back two more times. I think because
she went on and had a great career.
Yeah, but, like, I think that character, like, I remember that just being something that, okay, this is something that's identifiable. This is Narnia. Like, this is something that it's not easily replicated. It's fairly unique.
Uh-huh.
You know, so it, like, other
they went the opposite direction of Barbara Kellerman and BBC.
Yeah,
really,
so
with the
it
character,
so it
ways.
Very like when I think, like, what was, like, the most iconic character, something that I think is going to kind of, like, it's the thing that people are going to kind of remember or whatever. Like, I think the White Witch.
If you capture, I think, even half of what yeah, but if you capture even half of what Aslan is in the books, I think you'll have an iconic character. Yeah, so, I guess if I had to pick one, I'd go with the White Witch, but I don't think there were really any characters in the other movies that stand out in my mind as being something different and special. From
it's like, it should have been Aslan. Like,
can you give an example of how, because you said she opened your eyes in terms of how, like, 100 little things. Can you give an example of, like, a couple things that maybe you hadn't thought of, or just in terms of how Aslan was kind of minimized?
I'm trying to remember exactly what you're referencing.
It really said something brilliant is what he said.
I'll take credit for it.
You made the overarching statement to me that kind of, it's not just that one line from Father Christmas. It really is a bunch of little things. And then when we were doing the commentary, the 10th anniversary commentary a couple of years ago, I realized, one example might be the fact that the Beaver's dinner table scene, where all the information about Aslan comes out, and the movie is played for laughs. And in the book, there's this reverence to who's this Aslan character. Maybe little things like Aslan's roar when the witch is in camp. And how do I know your promise will be kept? And in the book, you know, Aslan roared. It was so loud. His mouth got wider and wider. And the witch, you know, picked up her skirts and ran for her life. In the movie, she's just kind of like, oh, okay. and even roar isn't even that impressive. So it really is. Even, like, you get the sense that, again and again in the movie, that the White Witch and Aslan are equal forces, basically. You don't, like, when the witch hears the name of Aslan in the book, she's freaked out. And then she's, if anyone says that name again, they'll instantly be killed. But in the movie, you don't get that at all. When she hears Aslan's name, she's like, oh, really? Where's Aslan? So you just don't. It's just 100 little things where Aslan's importance and his power is, doesn't feel nearly as significant it is in the book.
It's probably why it diminished how significant his death was.
Exactly. Yeah. That's another great example. Yeah.
Because when you think
about,
doesn't
feel,
like,
that significant in the
movie. I remember like anticipating that scene in the movie, and I was like, it's gonna, like, you know, you're just,
when he dies, you mean?
Yeah, like the death scene, and, like, you're thinking, like, if this is the, like, if it has the same emotional punch that it has in the books, like, this is going to be, like, really, like, because it's a movie and you have the, you can see it, you're not just reading, you don't have to imagine it. And then I remember watching it, it was just like, it was sad, but it wasn't like
sad because it's not happy.
Well, it's sad because obviously, yeah, you know, yeah, this lion seems like a nice guy, and, you know, who likes to see this beautiful lion get tortured and killed? Obviously, sure, it's sad.
Yeah.
But in the book, it's despair. It's our,
like,
only hope is gone.
Yeah.
It's like, all our hopes were pinned on Aslan, and now he's
really
dead.
It really is kind of the Obi-Wan death.
Mm-hmm. And
it's
then,
like, yeah, but Luke's still there.
Okay, so one, exactly. And yeah, exactly, because they emphasize the kids so much. The kids are the real heroes. So when he dies, it's, well, that cool lion probably would have come in handy, I guess, but it's really the kids who are going to save Narnia. So it almost, I think in the movie, it feels weird that so much time is spent on the death. Just, you know, separating my knowledge of the books completely. Yeah. When I'm just watching the movie, it almost seems weird that so much time is spent on the death of Aslan when he's not that important of a character in the movie. It's really the kids who are the heroes in the movies.
And I understand, like, it was, like, it did take, I think, for the production to have gotten that right, it would have taken an innate understanding of like who Aslan is and like what he represents in the story, and I don't think that understanding was quite there.
Yeah.
And then when you don't have that, then it really is extremely difficult to translate onto screen, mm-hmm. especially when he is not physically present yeah. very much.
And I think the reason they don't have it is, again, it came from an underlining. Oh, we're trying to make a sort of spiritual sequel to Lord of the Rings. So everything is, how do we essentially make another Lord of the Rings movie, but take these Narnia elements and fit it into that mold? And there isn't really an Aslan in Lord of the Rings. No. I know that, like, yeah, you know, buried in the Tolkien mythology there's something, but in yeah. terms of the story you saw in Lord of the Rings, there isn't really anything like Aslan. So that's why at all the three movies, it's like, well, what do we do with Aslan exactly?
Well, they kind of make him the Gandalf of the story, which saying, well, you know, he's really important, and if he dies, it really kind of hurts the effort
thing.
And yeah, it's really bad if he dies, but don't worry, they bring him back, and
yeah.
but it doesn't all rest on him, really. It's on these other heroes.
When Edmund died, that was like, or when he was like dying,
one of the best moments in all the movies. Yeah.
And it's actually more dramatic and sad, because you kind of wonder for a split second, you think, just in the moment, you think,
wait
a minute. Yeah.
Yeah.
But, uh-huh. and all that's just kind of just to tie in, it's just the importance of Aslan and the Silver Chair and how it's easy to just gloss over, especially because he doesn't have as much screen time.
He only has a couple scenes.
Yeah, he only has really a couple scenes. And
but his presence is so important.
Yeah. It is. And I kind of, and we should also say at this point, because we've been talking about, hey, what are things that are things we're afraid of seeing or things we just don't want to see. A lot of what we've been hitting on, for someone, is we're talking about things that are, it's really hard to do. It's really hard.
Yeah,
like if we're talking about, okay, if you have this important character, how do you get the character of Aslan right? Well, that's a hard task. If you're mm-hmm. talking about the relationship between Jill and Eustace, having hey, let's get an audience really emotionally invested in this young boy and girl, and there's no romance. There's more of a challenge there.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So we're talking about things we realize it's hard to do. But we also, you know, sometimes some stories, to make a really great story, there's a lot of hard things that have to be done.
Mm-hmm. But we believe in you, David McGee.
Yeah.
Or we're rooting for you.
Yeah.
Well, we believe in you too. Sorry.
I mean, when you think about it, like...
Edit!
go ahead.
No, I was just going to say we realize that, you know, we're not just... We understand, like, this is why filmmakers do these certain things, because sometimes... It's just easier.
Yeah.
Like, well, we can get this audience invested in this character this way. This
will look great in a trailer. By the way, your Stump and Narnia Weber question might be related to this issue. So it's coming.
So are we ready to move on to the next
kind of our
next thing?
Yeah. More positive
stuff
of hopes.
Because we're not all about the sad, depressing stuff.
Believe it or not, yeah.
We are not all about the sad, depressing stuff.
I'm all about the sad, depressing stuff.
He has a job.
Thanks so much for listening. You'll be able to hear the rest of this discussion in our next episode. In the meantime, do you have any concerns about the Silver Chair? Please post a comment. We'd love to hear from you. Until next time, further up and further in.